Some of you had asked about the poem that Tom read, and so he's written up here the name of the poem and the author, and I'm sure you can find it on the internet. So there it is. Want to thank the Brown Group for today's refreshments. And next week, the Green Group is up. So be alert. I would like to begin by telling a story that occurred to me at the break about fear and letting go. And this story goes back to 2008. I was with a friend. We were with a tour group in South America. And somewhere about Buenos Aires, I think, the stock market started going down. And all we had was, at that time, was CNN. And so we would look at CNN and see the stock market going down and down and down. So we got to Rio de Janeiro. And, of course, you can imagine how we were feeling. We were watching this happening, and there was nothing we could do about it. Now, I have been trying to do centering prayer for many years. And one of the things we pray about is, God, set me free from the need for affection, the need for control, and the need for security. Okay, so now I'm in Rio de Janeiro, and our tour group goes up to the top of the hill where the Christ figure is. And at my knees, as always, were a little bad, so I didn't do a lot of walking around. But behind, on the back side of the Christ figure, was a little chapel. Have any of you ever been there? So you know what I mean. So I went into the little chapel, and I was sitting there, and all of a sudden, one of those moments came. And it was, the moment was, well, you have been praying to be set free from control and from need for security. And it was almost like it was said with a laugh. And so, but what happened as a result of that was, it was so freeing. I thought, okay, nothing I can do about it, let it go. And of course, with hindsight, that was the very best thing I could have done. But anyhow, it did set me free and brought me up short. So anyhow, we are ready to move on with more questions. And
yeah, be careful what you pray for. That's how I became a priest. Careful what you pray for. Tell us about that. Let me see if I can do the kind of the quick version. So, as Martha mentioned in the little introductory bio, I was a corporate person for years and years. I had been raised Roman Catholic, then got involved with the Episcopal Church, and got very involved. And someone would invite me to do something, and I would say yes. Because I have bad boundaries, and I got involved a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, and at every juncture, I was like, that's enough, that's good, until one day I was having a chat with one of the priests at the parish I was part of, and I told her about, in my job, I had been feeling kind of stuck. I'd been in my position for a long time, so I'd gone to my bosses and said, kind of, what's next for me? Like, what should I be working for? I gotta be doing something else. And so to shut me up, they sent me to a career counselor, who gave me all sorts of different psychological tests and so on and so forth. And it was kind of the "what do you want to be when you grow up" tests. And what came out repeatedly on different instruments was to be a teacher or a minister. And so I thought the minister part was hysterical. And so I'm like, oh, teaching. I kind of do teaching in my job. I could kind of see that. And so I sort of started pursuing that. But anyway, I was relating the story to the priest at my church. And when I said, because I thought she would get a kick out of it. When I said, you know, it says priest or a teacher. And she just nodded. She just nodded. And I'm like, what? And she said, well, every time when you read scripture, she's like, I've always thought, I wonder if that's Elizabeth's calling. And I said, that's your problem. That is not mine. Like, you're projecting on me or something, but that is not my problem. That stayed with me. Like, it was, in the moment, it was like someone saying, yeah, tightrope walker. I could see you as a tightrope walker, or fire eater or something equally ridiculous. But it stayed with me. And then I went back to her and like, okay, so what do I do now? And she started me on the process. But I kept on, in my prayers, I kept on throwing up objections. Like, okay, God, I had grandparents, but that's all I've ever worked with, an older population, and priests have to work with older populations, so there. And then, like, the next week, I got a call from a deacon in our church who did a service every Sunday at two different nursing homes, did a Eucharist service, and he was announcing that he was retiring, and he was calling people to take that over, and he said, I'm not sure why, and we didn't know each other well. He said, but I thought of you. I'm like, damn, okay. And then I'd pray, like, okay, so priests have to work with, like, you know, kids and teenagers and stuff like that, and I have no experience in that at all. And then again, within about a week, these people who led the confirmation class at my church, they were about to head off to seminary, and they said, we want to bring someone in, and we thought of you. And we didn't know each other well, and so they knew nothing about anyway, be careful what you pray for. So, anyway, so I was just invited in. It was a kind of a long, slow process, and I went kind of kicking and screaming the whole way, Catherine. But once I gave into it, it was like, oh, yeah, this fits. This, yeah, it was the right thing. Anyway, sir.
I'm a tool nut, and I often feel intimidated by things like the rule of St. Benedict and the Franciscans and these different groups of people who don't own any personal stuff. It all belongs to the group. Well, I recently turned 77, and I'm a retired physician. My girlfriend says she can't move in with me because I have too much stuff. And she says, you can't move in with me because you have too much stuff. And I have felt a little intimidated, but I've kind of justify having too much stuff. I don't have a lot of knickknacks. I don't have fancy furniture. I live in a tract home out in Goleta. But I'm a blacksmith, a woodworker, a locksmith, a knife maker. I make quilts. When my wife died in 2003 of pancreatic cancer, her best friend said, you should make a quilt out of her clothes. Wow. So I started reading my daughter's quilting book for 2 hours and started cutting and sewing. And it was great grief work, you know. You can't be in denial when you're sitting there cutting up their stuff. Well, I, since then, have made over 50 quilts.
Wow.
And I've only kept about six. The rest of them have all been given away as gifts. And I justify having my stuff in order to gift people and share. See, I thought, I'm not sharing my tools. Well, I used to share my tools, but most people don't respect tools. They'd take a plane that I loaned them, and they'd set it down on a hard surface, and the blade would get chipped or dulled or whatever. And if I belonged to a group where I had to share all that stuff, I wouldn't be able to make and gift things because the tools wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of justify having all that stuff because the stuff I make is something that people benefit from, mm-hmm. just as they would if I belonged to the Franciscans, for instance, and they shared my tools. The tools wouldn't last forever.
Mm-hmm.
I have kind of a cute story. I have a really serious ability to design and make things. And when something breaks, I can figure out what's wrong with it and fix it. So I was the maintenance chairman at St. Mark's Church in Isla Vista. And I was out there one night working, fixing stuff. And the pastor came in with one of the associate priests. And he had asked me to take a look at the coffee machine because he wanted to get a new coffee machine.
Okay.
And I took a look at it, figured out what was wrong with it, went down on De La Vina Street, got the parts, and fixed it.
Where were you yesterday? Our coffee machine just broke.
I was going to San Luis Obispo to get a CPAP machine because I have sleep
apnea.
Okay. But anyway, so the pastor is talking to the associate, and he says, if you have something that you want fixed, don't tell Jim Jones about it because he'll fix it. And I did fix it, and he couldn't go out and buy the new coffee machine that he wanted to get. So kind of a backhanded gift.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway, what is your comment about that? Because I used to feel guilty about having all this stuff that I used to gift people.
Yeah. Well, guilt is not a useful emotion. So I would say get rid of it. Psychologist, would you say, yeah, down with guilt, down with guilt. Right. Your comment about gifting others, I couldn't find my note in the margin, but I had made that comment to myself that once my daughter went off to college, and especially after she got her own apartment, it was my great pleasure when we'd be talking on the phone and she would say something about how, well, that they, she and her girlfriend couldn't eat a certain kind of pasta. She really likes orzo, the tiny little rice-shaped pasta, because they didn't have a strainer. And so if you try to use like a pot lid to like strain it out, and I'm thinking, you need a strainer, right? But, she's making like no money at all. So even, $10-$12 for a strainer. So I immediately, got on Amazon and magically a strainer showed up at their house 2 days later. And I've done that over and over just because it gave me such pleasure. She's a very low maintenance person. She's a fix it, get it secondhand at Salvation Army kind of thing. But, there's something about, if you're a parent, just like giving things to your kids that they need. It is, now I can't remember the scripture, but it is, it is the Creator's great pleasure to give you what you need, right? I would say I think that's a good reason for stuff. And when I think about the thing, yes, she needed a strainer, though life wouldn't end if she couldn't eat orzo pasta. But the thing wasn't the thing. The thing was me wanting to feel needed as a parent, right, with an independent child and wanting to bring joy. I'm guessing that when you gift things, part of the pleasure is seeing people respond to the gifts that you give. So it's not just about the warmth of a quilt, but it's about it's like prayer shawls, right? It's the but you are in it. You are in this thing that you made. You are giving something of yourself. So I'm not anti-stuff at all. I think if we're sort of compulsively buying stuff because there's a, like, what is it that we think we're really buying, right? So if I'm bored, if I'm scared, if I'm something else, maybe there's a better way to satisfy that space in me than buying a thing. So kind of examining what am I doing this for? For me, I mean, I'm still going to buy my kid stuff and send it to her because I want her to know, Mom's still here. Mom's looking out for you, and I've always got your back. I mean, that's not all I do for her. I mean, we, you know, talk and have a relationship and everything, but I get it. So
it fulfills my need to feel needed.
Ah, there's another one.
I made a full set of kitchen knives for each of my three children as wedding presents.
Oh.
And they will be family heirlooms.
Yeah. Can I give you a hug?
I still don't know. I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up.
Yay. Thank you.
So one of the two chapters is, do I really need this now?
Mm-hmm.
And he really needs those tools now because he's using them.
Yep.
But, you know, if you had a set of tools for something you weren't doing, then you should probably get rid of them. And I don't know how you can fit your girlfriend in. You'll have to figure that out. But depends on what you need. But I like, one of the things that I think that we should think about our stuff is, can we get rid of it and how to get rid of it? And for me, I'd like to get rid of a lot of stuff, but it's hard to figure out where to give it away, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I put the little sign over there that says, do I need this now?
Do I need this now?
And
yeah.
It's stuff that is just hanging around my house, and I might find another use for it, but you might like something that I have. And I just think we ought to think about that more. You know, we all spend too much time buying stuff, and could we just trade our stuff around? Anyway.
Right. But I think, yeah, the comment, and I did like that comment that she made at the end of the chapter, do I need this and do I need this now? But I think it needs to go one level deeper, which is, what's the fear? What's the fear behind what's underlying that, right? So even with my child, it's like, my fear of, you know, we're across the country and I don't want to drop out a relationship with her, and the need to be needed. I get that. And so, you know, that's some of the hanging on to stuff, right? So I think I don't think it's sometimes as easy as just saying, do I need this? Do I need it now? I think sometimes there's some deeper work that goes on about the emotion, right?
Hi, welcome. I would like to address hospitality again. Although I was raised Catholic and was familiar with nuns, I never was part of an order, and nor do I know anything about monastery life. I have not read the Rule of Saint Benedict, but today, as you were addressing hospitality, I like to think of myself as being hospitable and have opened my home to visitors. But there are times, I wonder what Saint Benedict or monastic orders think about what happens when the guest is not hospitable from their standpoint. Because I think we've all perhaps experienced the feeling of, gee, I wish that guest wouldn't stretch out on my couch and put his dirty feet on my couch when I've offered him the bedroom and he can go take a nap on the bed, because
right.
I'm not used to seeing, you know, kind of a quasi-stranger in a way, or whatever, a friend of a friend, use my couch in that manner.
Mm-hmm.
And all kinds of other ways, even with my own grandchildren, who maybe don't respect my space the way I respect theirs. So I'd like to address and see what you have to say about hospitality from the other direction.
The other direction. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And I had thought about that. Actually, interestingly, so this Saturday, periodically, so I live in the rectory, in the house that the church owns, and do a lot of entertaining, which is a great joy for me. This Saturday is a newcomer event, and one of the people that has signed up to come, I'm not sure whether she actually will or not, is someone. She's a transient person. We've seen her, you know, sleeping in a tent in the park and so on. But often she's very disruptive and she's very aggressive. Can be very aggressive. She has kind of verbally attacked several people at our church, and I'm nervous about her coming to my house. And then I'm reading this chapter going, well, I'm looking for the loophole. Because I have a fear of, yeah, the person who, when are they going to leave or get their feet off the couch? But interestingly, it's on page 123. I like this. Guests have responsibilities too. They are not to make excessive demands that upset the monastery, Benedict warns. So there's a reciprocity there, right? There's a, and I think sometimes in hospitality that it means, or we take it to mean that we can't have any boundaries at all. And I think that is not the case. So as a Christian, I look to Jesus and I think, now Jesus was no doormat, right? So he was excessively hospitable, but he also had boundaries, and there was appropriate behavior and not appropriate behavior. And so so there's, you know, that's holding those two things in tension. Now, you know, how you say that and not sound like, you know, a jerk when someone comes over, I'm still figuring that out. And if anybody has an answer to that, you know, good luck. But or share it. But there is, yeah, as a guest, if I'm in your home, I have a responsibility as well. And I think we can call people on that. I mean, when I think about, like, this person I'm referencing in our congregation, I'm like, okay, I want to be welcoming and hospitable to her, but at the same time, I have a responsibility to everyone else in that congregation, right? She doesn't have a right to, she really lit into our sexton the other day and just yelled at him and belittled him and went after him, and I'm like, not acceptable behavior at all. So told him, you don't have to put up with that, you know, come see me. So I think there can be boundaries, and it's still hospitable, right? But it's partly, like that gentleman said, if he lends out his tools and you put the plane down on the wrong, it's not going to be sharp anymore, and it's not going to be usable, and so... So no, you don't have to let your house be trashed to be hospitable. So thank you for bringing that up.
A thought occurred to me about the simplicity thing. I understand a lot of millennials can't afford to buy houses anymore, obviously. Some of us older people are having problems, too. I inherited one, luckily, or I never would have bought one in Santa Barbara this time. But it seems to me that they're buying these small houses, tiny houses, they call them. I don't know if there's any, they can put them in Santa Barbara or not, but in some places they do. And it's got to be, the way they're set up is that you can get everything in there that you really need, but not everything that you want. You know, in other words, there's a space for things, and you have to really watch your space. You know, maybe that's what it's coming to. I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing in a way, so we won't have to have all this stuff. We can get what we really need, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, that does it by necessity. I've watched those shows, and they're really kind of intriguing. And then I look around and think, where would I put my, I don't know, 3,000 books that doesn't really fit? There you go.
Back again. A couple things. One is, you know, I live in the foothills, so I've evacuated several times. I don't wait. If I'm in the non-mandatory and I'm on the whatever list, I'm like, we're not waiting with 5,000 people on one freeway to get out of town. So I noticed every time I evacuate, I take less and less. Less and less. It's really been a practice of saying, what really, if it all goes, what are the things that matter here? And that van's gotten less and less and less stuff in it every time I roll out of that driveway. And the other thing is, I'm almost 60, so I have a lot of friends who are, their parents are dying, and they're left to clean up their houses and their things. And I have a friend who I've been helping recently, whose parents have been gone 2.5 years, and they were collectors of absolutely everything. I mean, everything. And, she's like, every time she walks to something, she tells me the story of it. And this was my great-grandmother's such and such. And I said, how about if I videotape you telling that story? So your daughters and your nieces and nephews know the story, because she's the keeper. Because I'm in my family, the nostalgic one that knows where everything came from and whose it was. And I said, I'll videotape you and then give it to the person you want. And then she had all her parents' pictures. So you walk in there, it's like a mausoleum to them, like a tribute. And I said, the first thing I really recommend you do is take all the pictures off the walls, because it's them. They're all staring at you, and you can't let go of anything because it's all like them. And she did that, all these things. And so I was tender about her mother. Her mother had one little box of very special stuff that every time I went, she told me about. And I said, today I give you the assignment to take that home. It's so special to you, and you've told me this story 5 times, and I know this is the most meaningful thing, so get it out of this house, because the more that things were held in that house, the harder it was, because it was not like their bowls and their dishes and stuff. And she was great. When my daughter got her apartment at UCLA, she was like, wonderful, take this, take that, take this. So anyway, I know that a lot of people are at that phase in their lives, and even I am thinking now I should thin out for my daughter, because you never know when you're going. But yeah, especially those precious items that are going to cause a fight, that are going to be a problem for somebody else. But if it's you that's in them, that might be the thing to let go of now, just because your kids are going to be having to sift, and this is painful to watch. So anyway, just a thought for a lot of older people that are in here, including myself. So I'm going to go home and get rid of some clothes that no longer fit me.
For the homeless people.
Catherine, I love that the way you addressed it with your friend, of recognizing that she's hanging on to the stuff, because the stuff's not the stuff. The stuff was the stories and the memories and the wanting to have something to pass on. I joke that with my parents did a great job. My mom died in January, and helping my dad close up his house was pretty easy, because he'd been, when he discovered eBay like 12, 15 years ago, all of a sudden they were just like selling things off one by one. And I joked that I said, at some point you're going to be in the kitchen at a card table, each of you with one plate, one spoon, and one coffee cup, and that's it. Like, that's all you need, right? But they were starting to get rid of stuff. Like, my dad collected chess sets his whole life. I mean, really interesting ones, and he started selling them on eBay. They did not need the money, right? But we all said, like, some of us kids might like that, and it had never occurred to him. So he then, came up with a system for that. So we wanted that, that connection. My parents were or are not stuff people, but there were certain things, like, you want that connection and that longevity and carry on those stories. So I applaud you for finding a way to do that for your friend. That was beautiful. Still a house full? Okay, there you go. There you go. There you go. Great. Anna?
Well, that's timely of you, Catherine, because it's given me inspiration. I have a lot of stuff at my ranch in New Mexico, where I have a retreat center, and there's space. There's a machine shed, and there's underneath the retreat center. And I have stuff that's been sitting there for 25 years since my mom died, and my grandmother's stuff, and 20 years since my father died, and 15 years since my twin died, and 4 years since my husband died. And next week, I found this professional lady who lives near my little place in Santa Fe, who's coming to get rid of the stuff. She happened to have gone to Pacifica here, but she lives out there now, and she is going to help me go through it all so that my kids don't have to deal with it all when I die. Maybe they want something, but I don't think they really need anything there that's just been sitting for all those years. Mm-hmm. So,
great. Thank you.
I've got one last thing to say about stuff. My mother decided, after going through my father's stuff, it was really very painful, and she decided she didn't want anybody to go through her stuff. I think part of it was the embarrassment and feeling the invasion. Once she died, everybody would go through her stuff, and she didn't have a lot of, you know, antiques or expensive things, but her mission the last few years was to get rid of stuff. So gradually she would, you know, get rid of stuff. She moved into a mobile home here in Santa Barbara. And then she developed Lewy body. She still had her mind. It wasn't the dementia part. But she couldn't do much of anything. And she ended up in a fairly different homes. And for 7 years we kind of went through that whole process of her losing everything and dying. But at one point my brother was kind of the one that took charge of everything, and she had a bunch of stuff in storage, and she was going to be moving into a smaller place, so he decided to have a garage sale in the storage unit. Well, that wasn't allowed, of course. I mean, all these people started coming in. It was in Santa Maria. So they said, you got to get out of here. You got to get this stuff out of here. So he loaded the truck up, and he went on the sidewalk out in front of the storage locker and unloaded everything and said, free stuff. And the police came by, and they said, what are you doing? He said, I'm giving away stuff. And there was no law against it. So we had all of my mother's stuff on the sidewalk, and it was wonderful. People came and stopped, and they took everything. But I had to stop one thing, because somebody took my wedding album.
Oh.
I hadn't noticed that was in there. But it was just this freeing, like all these people could just come and get these beautiful, you know, things. And so she ended up finally going to Sarah House at the end. And she was only there like a day and a half. And that's another whole beautiful story of her passing. But I will never forget when I walked out of there, I had two paper bags, literally, of her personal stuff. And that was all that was left of her, and that was her wish. And so now I've had to move a couple of times in the last couple of years, and each time I look at everything, am I going to take this? Does it mean something? And the rest goes. And I really honed down from a huge ranch with animals and barns and whatever into a very small space within a year. And I just have those things that have memories, and I'm still going to have to hone down. But I just have one little plug. If anybody has stuff they want to get rid of by next week, the Junior League Rummage Sale is coming up next weekend, and you can drop your stuff off at Earl Warren Wednesday and Thursday next week, and it will benefit all these programs, including a safe house for trafficked girls here in the community. So it's a place to put your stuff.
Great. Thank you. Michael.
Elizabeth.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
Long time no see.
Yeah, long time no see. Yeah.
Boy, I had a couple thoughts, but one extra one coming up here. So I'm sure people have heard of it, but I highly recommend The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, which is a very small book.
Oh, the Marie Kondo book? Yeah.
I found it to be very helpful. I still have a lot of, I'd say crap instead of stuff, but I'm doing a lot better.
Yeah, there was a comedian. Who was the guy who talked about other people's stuff is crap and your own crap is stuff? Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
Anyway. So Gordon, with his story about the tiny houses, and he used the same phrase, actually, is one my mother was famous for, and she would always say, my wants are many, but my needs are few, which is good words to live by. But I wanted to use that. You kind of threw out to us asking about the wisdom of the group, and I'm not sharing any wisdom I have, But in terms of your question about how do we overcome and what can we do, in the early chapter, the first or second chapter of our book, Judith points out that the very first word in the Rule of Benedict is listen. Mm. And then goes on to talk about listening with the ear of the heart. And I think those are, I think that's really, really wonderful to think about in terms of overcoming fear of others, which gets in the way of hospitality quite a bit.
Anything else? Come on down.
I think our generation, after the war or whatever, I was born in 48, created a massive epidemic of consumer, whatever the word for it.
Oh, like consumerism?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And it's really scary, and it's just created an insane society. I know my family was puritanical, and so you couldn't wear any bling, no jewelry, no furs. You couldn't have a, you know, fancy car, or you couldn't have a fancy house. And so it was, you know, you couldn't do this stuff for a religious reason, because the number one sin is pride. Okay, and so what did we create? You know, we created this huge monster that feeds the ego. You know, I remember my son, like in sixth grade, all of a sudden he went from like being friends with everybody and just, you know, this kind of love fest at his school. And then all of a sudden it was like, I have to have these certain kinds of shoes. I mean, it was insanity. I thought, oh, that's when the ego comes in, about fifth or sixth grade, in which something happens. They lose that innocence. And like my kids would say, I'd ask them in October, what do you want for Christmas? And they'd tell me. So I go out and buy it, you know, and hide it. And then the next month they'd say, oh, about something different. And I go out and get it. And then by November, like, they didn't want any of that. It was something else. Finally, I just said to them, you know, Santa can only bring one thing. Mm-hmm. And they got that. They said, we'll take a Nintendo, please. So then they said, well, we want to go to college. We want to go to Berkeley, where you went, and we want to go to UCLA, and we want to go blah, blah, blah. I said, no, you're all going up to City College. It's free. I'm not going to spend $50,000 for each of you every year for you to be drunk and party. Now, they weren't going to do that anyway, but I had to outsmart them. I had to figure out something I could say to them that would overcome their ego about where they were going to go to college. And you see that manifest now in prison terms for parents who get caught up in where their kids are going to college. Mm-hmm. It's the sickness is so unbelievable. And so my kids were like, went for free to the number one city college in the world, you know, mm-hmm. had the best education. And now one of my daughters who went to Pacifica and stuff, she's $250,000 in debt. Mm. Unemployed and homeless, basically. And it's, you know, it's causes mental disorder, I think it caused. So what we do to our kids when we lose that, there's that pride. It's all about pride. Look what I have, or look what I drive. And it's scary what we've done and really don't realize it. So
yep.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. Yeah, I was just thinking, I think there's so much about, you know, kids wanting to belong and the jeans or the shoes or whatever that helps them with that. But your thing about sort of the post-war consumerism, I wonder if there's something, the story I told about the holding bread, you know, the kids who knew of needing to hang on to something because they'd gone through such a time of fear and deprivation. people from my own congregation have heard me tell the story of my my grandparents, who were born in the 1890s. So they were adults during the Depression, and you know, their practice, they were never wealthy, but they were always, you know, had a roof over their head. But you know, they did the saving the foil and the washing out plastic bags and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But they had this practice of, when they went to the grocery store, they bought like excessive amounts of canned goods, right, if stuff was on special. And so when we cleaned out their storage locker, there was so much stuff there. But I think it was that like when they found something on sale, of grabbing it, not that they needed it, but having, you know, gone through the Depression, right? Just that mentality of needing that holding bread. So again, thank you so much for welcoming me here today. It was a pleasure.
And thank you very much. Just wanted to let you know that next week we will hopefully see you all back, and our speaker will be the Reverend Julie Hamilton from the Unitarian Society, who will talk to us about a Unitarian's view of the Benedictine Order. So it ought to be a very interesting day. So thank you all very much, and again, Elizabeth, thank you. Oh, I forgot something important, I think. We thanked the Brown Group and told the Green Group, right? Okay. We've got to have our refreshments. Thank you.